to accept my godhood. Keep your own god. In fact, this might be a good time to pray to him. For I beheld Satan and he fell from heaven like
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Bible Gumshoe Podcast, the podcast dedicated to answering tough questions about the Bible and its origins. I'm Nicholas LeMay, your resident Bible detective, and what you just heard, well, it's a clip from one of the worst movies based on video games that's ever been financed by Hollywood execs, in my opinion, who were probably high at the time that the idea was pitched to them. Yep. Street Fighter, the 1994 Japanese-American film featuring the never Oscar-winning Jean-Claude Van Damme. But, of course, as campy as that movie is, I think the clip serves to illustrate how in the culture, what I'm calling the Lucifer myth has come to permeate the imagination of Christians and non-Christians alike. Now, what do I mean by the Lucifer myth? Well, I don't mean to say that the Bible doesn't teach that there's a devil or demons or angels. The Lucifer myth refers to a certain set of now canonical cultural lore about the identity, activity, and origin of Satan and demons. Satan, commonly known as Lucifer. Now, I call it a myth because it seems to have its origins in a certain reading of two key texts from the Old Testament, Isaiah 14, 12 and following, which we looked at a couple podcasts ago, and Ezekiel 28, which we're going to look at in this podcast. So now these two texts, combined with other smaller texts scattered throughout the New and Old Testaments, and a good bit of conjecture on the part of creative exegetes, all come together to give us a story about the origins, activities, and identity of the devil. When we looked at Isaiah 14, we saw that in spite of what many people think, or what's even popular opinion, or what is even really embedded in the ethos of the culture, both Christian and non-Christian, Isaiah couldn't have had the devil in mind when he wrote that text. And to interpret the text that way requires the imposition of a whole set of cultural pre-understanding on an ancient text, which, of course, I think most of us will realize is a really, really bad practice. So, now, returning to the Lucifer myth in Western culture for a minute, I turn to a more classic and refined instantiation of the story. Yep, you guessed it, Milton's Paradise Lost. Listen to this. It's a great, great clip from BBC Radio 4's production of Paradise Lost with Dennis Quilly as Satan, I think, Ian McDermott, who's narrating it, and Matthew Morgan. The voices are fantastic. So listen to this.
Say first, for heaven hides nothing from thy view, nor the deep tract of hell. Say first, what cause moved our grandparents in that happy state, favored of heaven so highly, to fall off from their creator, and transgress his will for one restraint, lords of the world besides? Who first seduced them to that foul revolt? The infernal serpent. He it was whose guile, stirred up with envy and revenge, deceived the mother of mankind, what time his pride had cast him out from heaven with all his host of rebel angels, by whose aid aspiring to set himself in glory above his peers, he trusted to have equaled the Most High if he opposed, and with ambitious aim against the throne and monarchy of God raised impious war in heaven and battle proud with vain attempt. Him the almighty power hurled headlong flaming from the ethereal sky with hideous ruin and combustion down to bottomless perdition, there to dwell in adamantine chains and penal fire, who durst defy the omnipotent to arms.
And that was Ian McDermott dramatizing Milton's Paradise Lost for the BBC's Radio 4 production. Now, I'm an inquisitive mind, and being such, I wanted to explore the origins of this interpretation and how it made its way into the popular culture, into Christian thought, the history of Christian interpretation. Now, clearly, Isaiah 14 plays a very vital role in that, which we saw in episode 8. But Ezekiel 28, the taunt song over the king of Tyre, plays just as important a role in the Lucifer myth as Isaiah 14. So, in fact, they do so together and in conjunction with a lot of other smaller texts. So I have two questions as I approach this. The first is, when and where did this interpretation get a start? How and why did it come in to the history of Christian interpretation? And now the second is, what did Jewish interpreters think of it? How did pre-Christian Jewish interpreters understand it, contemporaries of the church fathers understand it, and then later medieval Jewish interpreters? So we're going to look at these, though not in all in this one podcast. We're going to look at the first question right now and take the second question of Jewish interpretation in a subsequent podcast. So how did this story, or the Lucifer myth, get its start in the history of Christian thought? Well, the main culprits in our story of woe are Tertullian, Cyril of Jerusalem, St. Augustine of Hippo, Jerome, Origen, among others. Now, since time doesn't permit us to do a deep dive into each one of these authors and their particular interpretations, we'll just have to pick a couple of them and do some flybys, so to speak. We'll have to summarize and sort of combine the different authors and see what it was that they were doing. Now, none of these church fathers seems particularly interested in dwelling on Ezekiel 28 as a text worthy of consideration all by itself. Only Jerome and Origen discuss it at greater length than all of the rest. Ezekiel 28 seems to form, for the fathers at least, one of the many weapons in a broader argument or apologetic against heretics or pagan opponents of Christianity. And in other words, rather than being its own topic of theological meditation, it's part of a larger apologetic against Christianity's detractors. Well, let's start with Tertullian. Tertullian brings Ezekiel 28 into the apologetic against Marcion. Yeah, Marcion. You remember that heretic that rejected the God of the Old Testament and only accepted the God of the New Testament? Well, not of the entire New Testament, of course, because in the New Testament we got lots of the Old Testament. But hey, remember him? Well, Tertullian was one of the early Christian writers and apologists who argued very strongly against him. Now, he argues against Marcion, who's making God out to be at least, if not fully culpable for sin, at least partially culpable for sin. Because, of course, it was the God of the Old Testament that created the devil, who enticed our first parents into the fall. So Tertullian says, "If, however," and I'm quoting here, "if, however, you choose to transfer the account of evil from man to the devil as the instigator of sin, and in this way throw the blame on the Creator, inasmuch as he created the devil," dot, 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 he goes on to say this, "if you turn to the prophecy of Ezekiel, you will at once perceive that this angel was both by creation good and by choice corrupt. For in the person of the prince of Tyre, it is said in reference to the devil, 'Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyrus, and say unto him, Thus saith the Lord God, thou sealest up the sum, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty. This belongs to him as the highest of angels, the archangel, the wisest of all.'" And he continues to quote Ezekiel, "Amidst the delights of the paradise of thy God wast thou born." Then Tertullian continues. He says, "This description, it is manifest, properly belongs to the transgression of the angel and not to the princes, For none among human beings was either born in the paradise of God, nor even Adam himself, who was rather translated thither, nor placed with a cherub upon God's holy mountain, that is to say, in the heights of the heaven, from which the Lord testifies that Satan fell, nor detained amongst the stones of fire, in the flashing rays of burning constellations, whence Satan was cast down like lightning. Of course, here we have the combination of Ezekiel 28 with the text of Luke 10:18, where Jesus says, and that he saw Satan fall from heaven or cast out from heaven. Now we can see here that Tertullian's burden is to argue that God is not the author of sin simply because he created the devil who tempted our first parents into sin. But rather, I think one of the key phrases here is you'll at once perceive that this angel was both by creation good and by choice corrupt. And he cites Luke and he cites Ezekiel and he brings the two together to argue against Marcion's accusation. Now, in Cyril of Jerusalem's catechetical lectures, he marshals a very similar argument and for similar reasons. In fact, he has the same apologetic in mind, that is, to show that God is not responsible either for the sin of Satan nor for the sin of man. He writes, "The devil then is the first author of sin and the father of the wicked. And this is the Lord saying, not mine, that the devil sinneth from the beginning. None sinned before him, but he sinned, not as having received necessarily from nature the propensity to sin, since then the cause of sin is traced back again to him that made him so. But having been created good, he has by his own free will become a devil and received that name from his action. And this is not my teaching, but that of the inspired prophet, you guessed it, Ezekiel. For he takes up a lamentation over him and says, thou wast a seal of likeness and a crown of beauty. In the paradise of God wast thou born. And soon after, thou wast born blameless in thy ways from the day in which thou wast created until thine iniquities were found in thee. Very rightly hath he said, were found in thee. For they were not brought in from without, but thou didst thyself beget evil. The cause also he mentions forthwith. Thine heart was lifted up because of thy beauty. For the multitude of thy sins wast thou wounded, and I did cast thee to the ground. Well, in agreement with this, the Lord says again in the Gospels, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. Thou seest the harmony of the Old Testament with the New, concludes Cyril. I think this is fascinating, and it's fascinating to see these two passages from Tertullian and from Cyril side by side. So we have very similar elements. For example, the devil's free will, his creation as good, his sinning and becoming the devil of his own choice, sin being found in him, not coming from without. And also, interestingly, both authors link up Ezekiel and Luke 10:18. And Cyril adds that great line, thou seest the harmony of the Old Testament with the New. And they were trying to harmonize both of the Testaments to show that there's one God in both Testaments and that this God is not the author of sin. He's not the author of man's sin, and he's not the author of the devil as enticer into sin. He didn't create the devil sinful, and he didn't make the devil sin. The devil, created free, sinned of his own free will. Both of these authors argue this way against Marcion. In Tertullian's case and in Cyril's catechetical lectures, he's arguing and making this argument for his students. Now, Augustine also has the same exact concern as the two previous authors do. He wants to free God from any blame for man's sin. Now, Augustine writes, as for what John says about the devil sinneth from the beginning. They who suppose, now, Augustine's arguing against the Manichaeans. He says, they who suppose it is meant hereby that the devil was made with a sinful nature misunderstand it. For if sin be natural, it is not sin at all. And how do they answer the prophetic proofs? Either what Isaiah says when he represents the devil under the person of the king of Babylon, how art thou fallen, O Lucifer, son of the morning? Or what Ezekiel says, thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was thy covering. Where it is meant that he was some time without sin, for a little after, it is still more explicitly said, thou wast perfect in all thy ways. And if these passages cannot well be otherwise interpreted, we must understand by this one also, he abode not in the truth, that he was once in the truth, but did not remain in it. So, okay, these three authors represent how the church fathers reflect on these texts and why they're reflecting on these texts the way they do. The apologetic concern here is the question of the origin of evil. Not necessarily the origin of the devil, but of the origin of sin and human misery. Do we place the blame at God's feet, or do we place it at man's or at the devil's? And if it can be placed at man or at the devil's feet, well, God is the creator of man and the devil, and so therefore we must blame God. And all three of these authors, among others of the church fathers, have this burden to free God from any blame of man or the devil's sin. We should understand that the church fathers are responding to attacks against the Christian faith, both from within and from without. Now, Origen's reflections on the text of Ezekiel 28 are an apologetic too. And in his context, it's an apologetic against pagan arguments against Christianity. So the primary concern of the fathers is both to defend God against the accusation of being responsible for sin and to answer heretical and pagan concepts of God and sin. The argument centers, of course, on the origin of the devil as being the one who tempted our first parents. So they use these texts to show that God had created, in summary here, the devil is the highest of the angels and perfectly good, but that he, the devil, had corrupted himself of his own free will by his pride and fell of his own accord, not God's. So now we know where and why this tradition about Satan, his origins, his fall, come into Christian thought. But where did the fathers get this interpretation from? Now that's a more difficult question to answer. They certainly didn't get it from their contemporary Jewish interpreters, as we'll see in the next podcast. They didn't get it from the New Testament, at least not directly. So where did it come from? Well, the interpretation of these texts as referring to Satan seems to arise in the first centuries of the Christian era. Now, that doesn't mean this interpretation isn't older than that, but it does mean that it wasn't prevalent. Now, what we'll see in the next podcast is that Jewish interpreters, both pre-Christian, medieval, and contemporaries of Jerome and Origen at least, had very distinct views on the meaning of these texts than did the church fathers. But again, their purposes in writing and commenting on these texts are also different from the purposes that the church fathers had. So the fathers and subsequent interpreters up to the present day took these two texts, one referring to the king of Babylon and another referring to the king of Tyre, and conflated them with other stories and other biblical accounts, such as Luke 10:18, like we just saw, 1 John, which Augustine quotes, the Apocalypse of John, otherwise known as Revelation, and perhaps other extra-biblical literature floating around out there, like we saw in the podcast on Isaiah 14 with the books of 1 and 2 Enoch. Now, there's a caution to be made here, I think, and that has to do with the propensity, and not only in the early Christian literature, not only in the church fathers, but even today, the propensity of interpreters of the Bible to take passages that have a passing similarity with each other and then come and mash them together like Plato and create a story out of that new creation. That's what the commentator Leslie Allen thinks has happened in this case. Now, Allen writes this. He says, The application of verses 11 to 19, he's speaking of Ezekiel, to Satan by 3rd and 4th century church fathers, Tertullian, Origen, John Cassian, Cyril of Jerusalem, and Jerome, and thence in some modern popular conservative expositions, is based on the Masoretic text equation of the king and cherub and on comparison with Isaiah 14, 12 to 15. It is a case of exegeting an element of Christian belief by means of Scripture and so endeavoring to provide it with extra biblical warrant and to fit the passage into the framework of the Christian faith. However, he writes, it is guilty of detaching the passage from its literary setting. I think he's right. But still, the church fathers were trying to be faithful to the text. They were trying to exegete it properly, even if they were conflating texts, even if they were putting together texts that didn't quite go together. They were still getting these ideas from somewhere. So what Alan says seems to be right, but it still doesn't give us a very satisfying answer to the question of where the fathers came up with the idea. Well, except for Luke 10:18 and some other texts we'll look at in a moment where Jesus says that Satan fell from heaven, Isaiah 14 where the morning star falls from heaven, we aren't really left with a whole lot by way of biblical literature forming the basis for such a complex myth as the one which developed in early and later Christian thought, and then of course became part of the canonical lore through the works of Milton, Dante, and others up to the present day. So if the New Testament really doesn't give us a whole lot to go on by way of the roots of this complex myth, what about extra-biblical literature? We saw in Episode 8 how 1st and 2nd Enoch describe the fall of Satan from heaven, but you know there were other myths in existence at the time too, and in earlier Jewish tradition as well. So for example, in the Qumran text, let's take the Qumran text, there's this fragmentary scroll called 11Q Melchizedek. And it tells a story of an epic eschatological battle in heaven between the divine being Melchizedek and his angels, and Belial and his evil spirits. Now, Belial being another name for the devil. The fragment contains the following account. It says, its interpretation concerns Belial and concerns the spirits of his lot, who, in their turning away from the statutes of El, to act wickedly, and Melchizedek will avenge the vengeance of the judgments of El from the hand of Belial and from the hand of all, and then it ... because, of course, it's a fragmentary manuscript. Now, that scroll in the third column ends like this. It has a line that reads, and they will consume Belial with fire. So we know that Belial loses, and probably his demons too, in this Qumran scroll, in this story. Now there's another scroll that was found in Qumran, in cave number one, that's called the War Rule. It contains a description, not of Melchizedek, but of Michael, the Prince of Light, and of an epic battle against Belial and his evil spirits. This dates from the late 1st century before Christ. And it says, and of old you appointed a prince of light as our helper, and in and all the evil, and there's a ... there, and all the spirits of truth are his rule. And it was you who made Belial for the pit, an angel of enmity, and in darkness is his rule, and it is his counsel to make wicked and to make guilty. And all the spirits of his lot are angels of violence. They walk in the boundaries of darkness, and together their craving is for it. But we are of the lot of your truth. Now, apart from the existence of these ideas among the sects at Qumran, and apart from 1st and 2nd Enoch, which you've already mentioned, we have other extra-biblical literature that either hints very directly or indirectly at possible origins for a modern-day Lucifer myth. For example, in pseudepigraphal literature, in the Book of Jubilees 2:3, there's a description of the seven heavens, which are the seven great works of God, which he created on the first day. There's also the Testament of Levi. I know, another one of your devotional favorites, right? Well, mine too. And in chapter 3, it says, hear about the seven heavens. It gives then a description of each one and says that in the third heaven, there are literally the powers of the barracks, or what we might understand as certain angelic armies, which are waiting for the day of judgment to execute judgments on the spirits of error and Belial. Now, Belial is just another name for Belial, or another name for the devil. And even sometimes in the literature refers to Antichrist. Of course, going back just to the book of 2 Enoch, because I can't resist, Enoch visits each of these heavens as a favored guest. Remember, he describes in 2 Enoch the Grigori, who are identified as the spirits who turned aside from the Lord, 200 myriads, together with their prince, Satanael. Of course, the book describes Satan as being hurled from heaven, together with those that rebelled against the Lord. Now, we saw this text already, but I can't resist repeating it. Now, these works seem to have had a significant influence on Irenaeus, for example. They had an impact. In other words, the point is here that they had an impact on the culture of the day, on the different writers and thinkers who were reflecting on Holy Scripture. And they may have had a significant influence, too, on the church fathers. Like I said, Irenaeus speaks of the devil as the strong man, the devil, and as that apostate angel. Irenaeus speaks of Satan as the first apostate angel who, together with those who sinned with him, was cast out of heaven and subsequently took man down into the same apostasy from God. Irenaeus goes on to develop quite an elaborate understanding of what D.R. Schultz calls the chain of apostasy, and he didn't get it from the New Testament. The New Testament in 2 Peter 2:4 speaks about God not sparing the angels when they sinned, but rather casting them into hell until the judgment. Jude talks about the angels that didn't keep their position of authority, but left their proper dwelling and were cast into hell. Of course, Jesus makes a very veiled reference, perhaps, to the ruler of this world being cast out in John 12:31, and in Revelation 12:7-12, we get the description of a heavenly battle between Michael. That's an interesting connection with some of the extra-biblical literature, and the devil, in which the devil is cast down to the earth with and his angels with him. We've, of course, already mentioned Luke 10:18, so we don't have to mention it again. And this is all that the New Testament says on the topic. The rest is either conjecture, extrapolation, or has come to us from other sources, like we're exploring here. Now, I admit, there's parts of the Lucifer myth that do clearly have points of contact with the New Testament. So we have the devil who's cast out, who falls. The devil has angels and they fall with him. But apart from that, we don't have much. So we do find in pre-Christian Jewish myth, it's been in the pseudepigraphal literature, such as Jubilees, Baruch, the Testament of Levi, which we just mentioned, and the Testament of Naphtali, a developed story about a rebellious angel who makes a pact with other angels to fall with him. And he and they are cast out of heaven, and then he goes on to defile man, either in the case of Adam or the angels, the fallen angels, come and defile human beings by breeding with women. And this pseudepigraphal literature is actually probably the basis for a more modern understanding that angels bred with women in Genesis and created a sort of superhuman race of giants. But we can come back to that in another podcast too. So it seems to be the case that many of the details of these stories found in the Jewish pseudepigraphal literature, the eschatological mythology of the Qumran sects, which in many cases predates Christianity by maybe 100 years, as well as in the Father's own contemporary literature, such as 1 and 2 Enoch, And a work that we didn't mention, but there is a work called The Life of Adam and Eve, which is also contemporary with the Fathers. Now, these works, like the ideas in these works, likely infiltrated the broader culture. And so the story of Satan's origins and speculation regarding angels and demons during the first centuries of the Christian era was born. Now, this is nothing new, and it still happens today. We're all children of our culture. We're all influenced by cultural myths without even being aware of it. And as these ideas permeated the writings of the church fathers, you know, they ended up becoming canonical lore in Christian tradition. But that doesn't mean that this is what the Bible's teaching in Isaiah 14 or in Ezekiel 28. In fact, what we most likely have in the case of early Christian exegesis of these texts is the imposition of other stories onto the Old Testament narratives, and for no other reason than they share certain literary similarities. And this isn't really a criticism of the Church Fathers as much as it is a caution to everyone, a caution to us all today, because we're all in danger of doing the same thing. Well, next time, we'll continue to look at Ezekiel 28, and we'll look at what Jewish commentators had to say about it, as we seek to unravel these complexities of a text that has figured prominently in the thought of biblical interpretation for nearly 2.5 millennia. So, if you have a question about the Bible or its history, or just want to reach out, you can get a hold of us at detective@biblegumshoe.com. That's detective@biblegumshoe.com, or visit our website at www.biblegumshoe.com. Also, please subscribe to the podcast and leave a comment on iTunes or the podcast provider of your choice. I would really appreciate that. I also want to send a big shout out to my friends in San Francisco. Well, I really don't know anyone over there except for some family who lives north of the Bay Area, and I've always enjoyed visiting the city, but apparently most of my listeners are from the Bay Area. So a grateful shout out to all of my listeners from the San Francisco area. Now, I can't think of a better way to send you off than with the BBC's dramatization of Paradise Lost and the enchanting voice of Satan.
The lost archangel Satan then thus spake.
Is this the region, this the soil, the clime that we must change for heaven, this mournful gloom for that celestial light? Be it so, since he who now is sovereign can dispose and bid what shall be right. Farthest from him is best, whom reason hath equalled, force hath made supreme above his equals. Farewell, happy fields where joy forever dwells.